times.
Yeah, I know.
Good afternoon. It is about 1:35 on Tuesday, January 30th, and I'd like to call this meeting to order. Present are Representative Ortiz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Tilton, Representative Grand, Representative Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Seaton, and Vice Chair Guerra. And I'll remind everybody about their cell phones. And today we will hear department budget overviews from the Department of Corrections and Public Safety and Natural Resources. Commissioner Williams, would you go ahead and you and your staff take place at the table? Would you prefer us to wait and take questions at the end, other than clarifying questions, or would you want them during your presentation?
Mr. Chairman, it's up to you. I'm happy with waiting to the end, and that works for me if that works for you.
Okay, and just for your knowledge, this presentation will end at about 35 minutes, 2:10.
Okay.
So just.
Very nice, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. For the record, Dean Williams, Commissioner for the Department of Corrections, with me is Director Wilkerson. And we'll just kind of march through them, Mr. Chairman, and get to the end, and I'll try to keep us on pace. So this is the mission. Slide number 2 is the mission of the department. And I guess at the outset of this presentation, Mr. Chairman, I would like to, at the outset, acknowledge and identify that, yes, our department in this fiscal year, in the governor's proposed budget, is increasing $22 million in these fiscal times. And I think we have to talk about that right out of the gate. And I guess I'd like to set the stage for what I've been 2 years in this job, and I've been looking back at what the history of this department has been and where the funding has been in this department, and I think to talk about the current budget, proposed budget, we have to review what has occurred in the last few years. And so let me just, for a very quick moment, entertain with you about where this department has been. And I'm going to generalize this in a very large way to say, but let me start here to say, our department has been on what I call the glide path of reductions over several fiscal years, with anticipations that we would arrive at a certain place in our prison population that will allow us to take advantage of certain savings. And I think that was well, I don't doubt any of the history of that or where it came from, but let me just quickly remind the committee that starting in 2015, fiscal year 2015, and there are kind of a number of different moving pieces. I mean, money was taken out of our department, money was put back in, but let me just give you the net loss out of every fiscal year as a big general overview, and we could talk about this in more detail later. But in fiscal year 2015, the department lost $1 million out of its budget for the entire department. Fiscal year 2016, we lost $8.5 million. Fiscal year 2017, $10.8 million. And out of fiscal year 2018, $11.8 million. And that totals to be about $32 million. So there were certain expectations about where we were going to at, but the reality is that without certain reductions, and this is even in keeping in mind that, in fact, I closed the facility. I took the difficult decision of closing the facility about 9 months into my tenure. So a little less than a year and a half ago, I, in fact, closed the facility to get particular savings, but we still find ourselves approximately $22 million short in terms of the operating budget. Hence, my request for the governor and the OMB team to make sure that we had full funding back in to really give a clear picture of what funding is going to cost to run this department. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll move on to the next slide, and I'll have Director Wilkerson go through the historical views of where we are at with not only general funds but all of our funds, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Wilkerson.
Good afternoon. My name is April Wilkerson. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. On slide 3, it is a representation of the overall general funds for the Department of Corrections over the last 10 years. In 2019, we are requesting $297 million be added to the general funds for the agency. That is an increase over FY18. The general funds make up just over 6.5% 6.3% of the overall governor's budget request. This is an increase of over 10 years ago of $79 million, where in 2009 we had a budget request of $217 million. Slide 4 is a representation of how those funds are allocated out. We do have the majority of our funds is dedicated to personal services at just over $210 million. Our next highest line is our services line, which includes our utilities, our contractual services, our halfway houses, and that makes up $98 million of our budget. The commodities, which is $19.8 million, that's the food, the housing, the clothing, the bedding, all of the operational costs for commodity purchases. We do have a small travel line of $1.8 million. The majority of that is associated with prisoner transports between our institutions to and from medical appointments, as well as we do have a small appropriation of just over $600,000 dedicated to returning inmates to their point of arrest upon release. We are asking this year in our governor's budget of $1 million for capital outlay. That is to address any annual maintenance and repair of the institutions that are operating. We are responsible for the facility upkeep of those institutions. On slide 5, our budget is allocated through 6 result delivery units, or RDUs. Population management is our largest RDU within the budget. It includes 3 divisions. That is the Division of Institutions, the Division of Probation and Parole, the Division of Pretrial Services, as well as the Board of Parole. That overall allocation makes up 80% of the DOC's overall general fund budget. HARS, which is Health and Rehabilitative Services, makes up the additional 15.6% of the budget. Administrative and Support makes up 3% of the budget. And offender programs and recidivism reduction budgets, they make up just over 1% of the budget. The population management budget, there is a increase to that. In FY19, we are asking for $10.4 million, and that will be allocated throughout the 12 operating institutions to bring them up to full funding. Their budget was reduced in FY17 and 18 in anticipation of further closures or constrictions of the beds, which are not being achieved at this time, so we are asking for full funding. We are also asking for $10.3 million be added to the Health and Rehabilitation Services, and that is associated with the increased medical costs of the prisoner inmate care. Slide 6 is a representation of the overall funds, all funds within the department, broken up by those various allocations. The federal funds have increased by $4.6 million. Those are primarily dedicated to receipts that we collect for the housing of federal inmates within our various facilities.
Before we go on, I want to recognize Jeffrey Newman joined us a little bit ago.
On slide 7, it is a distribution of our overall budget by fund source. Federal receipts, we do have, like I said, federal authorization that is collected. It's primarily made up of the housing of federal inmates that are housed within our various institutions. Our unrestricted general funds, they make up 87% of our overall budget at $289 million. Then we also have other funds that is allocated within the department at $25.7 million. Those would include items such as our facility CIP authorization, our mental health trust authority, interagency receipts. And then we also have a small amount, $8.5 million of designated general funds. We do collect funds from those inmates that are assigned to electronic monitoring, as well as collection of funds from other municipalities for the housing of inmates that are held on those local municipal charges. And then we also do have a collection of from the cost of incarceration that is collected through Department of Law and the courts.
So, Mr. Chairman, let me just start off, and I'll turn it over back over to Director Wilkerson. So, in your this slide is breaks out the different offices within the Division of Institutions, and then the subsequent slides do that for each of the other divisions as well. The one thing I'll just mention in terms of the preamble that I think last year when we presented to you, I think we were overly broad in saying we served all Alaskans, and I think you rightfully, as well as members of the committee, said, hey, you really try to narrow that down a bit more specific. We took that to heart. I think we may have, in fact, overtaken it to heart a bit, and I just want to mention one example. So in the institutions line, we have down, we're serving number of Alaskans of 4,800, individuals who are incarcerated with us as an average capacity or daily capacity, and that number goes up and down throughout the year, of course. But just on that one line, I'll just mention that some of the things we probably are not mentioning in here just is that every time we have a bookings, we have about 30,000 bookings a year. So in terms of the number of Alaskans served, I think we're very much on the conservative side of this scale now, maybe a little bit too much. But these bookings of people coming into our facilities involves a lot of work, and they don't stay very long, but they're I just want to point out to the committee, in each one of these areas where we now talk about Alaskans served, we're trying to get it right with all of you about how you want us to sort of describe that. But I'll just mention in that category, for example, we know we're missing a whole group of other people, of Alaskans who are served as a result of our budget. I know it's not a big point. I just wanted to mention it briefly before I turn it back over to Director Wilkerson.
On slide 8 is a representation of the Division of Institutions. As the Commissioner previously said, the budget has overall decreased, and we are asking for a portion of that back into our budget. But Alaska is one of 6 unified states throughout the country. We handle both prisons and that unsentenced population, as well as the sentenced population upon conviction. We do that by operating the 12 institutions throughout the state that is handled by the Classification and Furlough Office for appropriate placement and housing of those offenders. We're also responsible for the inmate transportation, which is delegated to the department by the Department of Public Safety. That delegation allows us to move inmates between our institutions for population purposes, as well as to and from medical appointments. We do have the point of arrest component within this division, and that again returns offenders to their point of arrest. And then we have a $1.5 million budget that is dedicated towards education and vocational education programs and efforts to assist individuals upon reentry back into our communities to obtain employment. We also have $16.8 million dedicated for our CRCs. And then we have $7 million that's allocated to the regional and community jail program. We have contracts with 15 local entities throughout the state. Slide 9 is our Division of Health and Rehabilitation. The overall budget is $58.559 million this year. That does include the ask of the $10.3 million that we're currently identified as a shortfall. That is also going to be reflected in the anticipated supplemental bill for FY18. That division encompasses our physical health care component that's required under statute to provide essential care to those individuals that are placed under the department's custody. It also includes the behavioral health component, as well as our substance abuse treatment programs, our sex offender treatment, our sex offender management programs, and our domestic violence programs.
Thank you, Director. Mr. Chairman, so just on the Division of Probation and Parole, I just wanted to acknowledge, make one caveat comment about our probation counts. This was a source of some conversation last year about what our probation counts are, and we have down number of Alaskans served at our, we have 3,075 as our capacity. This is an important sort of issue to sort of bring up that in terms of our budgeting for our department, that currently last year, about the same time, our average count last year was right around 5,100. So we had 5,100 people on probation last year. Right now, as we speak, we're at about 3,900 people on probation. And so the reason for that reduction is some of that has to do with earned compliance credit. It also has to do with changes in reform to our department in regards to for technical violations and making sure that you're bringing people back in for if you're going to bring them back in for long periods of time, it needs to be more than they just missed an appointment, but you know, ongoing problems. So that has brought our count down. With some of the changes that occurred in under Senate Bill 54, even we are set at a cap now of 3,075. And that was quite a bit of a discussion. So I view that as the commissioner as sort of our bent, I mean, as a potential goal of where we're going, knowing that that is a cap that's been set on us. We're not there yet. But I think some of the things that we're seeing in terms of this division, we have a reasonable chance of getting there. And at the same time, being very strategic about who we have on probation, how long we have people on probation. And it's a part of our department operations that we continue to look at very closely to make sure we have the right people on probation for the right period of time. And I just wanted to highlight that this is one of the areas of the department where we continue to work the sort of the problem and work the issue to make sure we really have the right supervision for the offender population that we're dealing with who are now back out and amongst us in the public. So, Director.
The Division of Probation and Parole encompasses about $21.2 million of the overall budget. That is broken up into statewide probation and parole, which covers 13 regional locations, and they provide supervision to those individuals under probation and parole that are released into our communities. Electronic monitoring is also part of that division, and that is currently operating in 6 locations with expansion into another 2 locations, Sitka and Barrow. We are also actively expanding the electronic monitoring program to other areas.
The Division of Pretrial Services, Mr. Chairman, of course, is a brand new division that was stood up just recently and actually has gone into full operation January, so it's been in operation for almost 4 weeks. This is in subsequent conversations where we can talk about this entire division and the effort of this division. I look forward to ongoing conversations about why this, I think, is a critical piece of our department. And I know we're going to have more discussions on this later in the subcommittee, which any of you are all welcome to be here, and I'll have my pretrial director here next week to talk about this because I think this is a very important topic to make sure we have real clarity about what we're doing in this pretrial enforcement division and why. Real briefly, I'll tell you, without stealing thunder for next week, is our largest growth in our prison population has been in the pretrial area for the last 10 years, like most other states around the nation. And these people are very expensive when they come to us. So you really need to make sure you have people in you want in pretrial in prison that you really want there because they're expensive and they cost money. And some of them need to be there because they clearly represent a risk by their charge, and we all recognize that. It's just one of the areas that is being stood up, and we're halfway there. I think we've done this the right way, quite frankly. We have about half of the number of the employees hired. I've also saved part of this money back to enhance community jails in your local communities to do some of the work. So us, the state, are not solely doing it. I think this is the right way of doing that. I can update you more next week in the subcommittee about how that's working and why I think it's working well. Most communities are on with it. Some are just kind of waiting and seeing about how this is going. But we're halfway there, and I think we've really stood this division up very wisely. Knock on wood, we're 4 weeks in, but I think the support for this division and really keeping this on the trajectory that we need it to be on is important for a whole host of reasons, and I look forward to talking about it more next week to really have a robust conversation about why this is the greatest promise in improving public safety, especially for the pretrial super people who have never had any supervision before, who have never had any monitoring before, and how we're using a risk tool as another tool, another option for the judge to use and make a decision about who should stay in and who should stay out. And in every other state where this has been done, of course, you've heard me say before, it has improved public safety when done appropriately and done well. And I think we're doing that. And so I look forward to a conversation, answers and questions about that, because I think it really is the one area that I couldn't be happier about where we're going in spite of all the challenges of standing up a brand new division. And I just wanted to highlight it that I know we're going to have more conversations about it, and I look forward to that, Mr. Chairman.
And before we go on, I want to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Guttenberg. And we were on slide.
So the Division of Pretrial Services does have an allocation of $10.2 million. It is a new division. We are, like the commissioner mentioned, getting it set up and established. However, one of the things that has been achieved to date is we have successfully negotiated with 11 of our 15 local community regional jails to provide those level of pretrial services on behalf of the pretrial unit. Slide 12 is the Board of Parole. It is housed within the Department of Corrections. They have a budget of $1.7 million. The Parole Board is responsible for determining the suitability of individuals for potential release onto parole from custody. They oversee the mandatory parole, the discretionary parole, and the special medical parole. They do also oversee the geriatric parole, and then they are working with the governor's office on the new clemency elements that the governor's office is implementing.
I'll just briefly mention, Mr. Chairman, that we believe that the parole hearings in the case that we're seeing right now are going to probably at least double, and I know the parole board is on full tilt now in terms of parole hearings, and they've done a great job of managing the workload and being creative, and but I do think we're going to see a dramatic increase in parole hearings. That was part of the intention, is to make sure that you're reviewing these cases and people who are eligible, or that they're just not sitting, that you're contemplating and you as the system are seriously considering whether or not somebody should in fact be eligible for parole. And that's going to increase the number of, it already has increased the number of hearings for the parole board.
The Division of Administrative Services oversees the administrative functions for the department. The budget allocation to that division is $9.7 million, and it includes all items such as the recruitment, all human resources, procurement, budgeting, financials. It also encompasses the offender management system. We also certify the breath and alcohol ignition interlock device program, and they also are responsible for the employee background checks and APSC certification. We also oversee all offender records. Those are active and inactive. We also have the responsibility of the maintenance of all of the institutions within the department. The division is actively coordinating and working with, in cooperation with, the Department of Administration on shared services elements. The Office of the Commissioner is allocated $3.76 million. They make up the Correctional Academy that provides the Alaska Police Standard Council training as required for all of our probation officers and our correctional officers. The Professional Conduct Unit is also housed within the Office of the Commissioner. And then we also have the Recidivism Reduction component, which is also within that division. Slide 15 is the five-year healthcare trends for the department. The overall amount allocated of the department's budget for healthcare, which includes our inmate healthcare, is 23.3%. Our employer contributions is just over $30 million, and our workman's comp is just over $3.8 million. Our inmate healthcare is the almost $40 million within that allocation. The employee allocation is 11% of that 23%, and the rest is made up of the inmate health care contributions. The department makes every effort to reduce the health care cost, and such as we post informational on our websites. We're sharing information with our employees. Each of the institutions are putting forward employee wellness programs within the facilities. We coordinate with the unions to have on-site wellness resources, including training, webinars, and group activities. For inmate efforts, we're moving higher cost cases out of state. We've been successful in placing two high cost dialysis in a lower cost facility in outside of the state of Alaska. We review our high cost medical cases as soon as they come to the attention of the department for a community placement to see if we can get them out of custody and under Medicaid.
Thank you. Oh, no, I'll ask later.
We're also making some other efforts, such as we're providing information to inmates, we're focusing on heart-healthy diets, and we are coordinating the efforts to issue vitamin D throughout the institutions. On slide 16, we added an element in here regarding our vacancy factor. And vacancy factor is intentionally underfunding positions in anticipation of turnover of positions that become vacant from a long-term employee and the efforts to hire in a newer employee into our positions. For the Department of Corrections, what that means is of our 1,895 budgeted positions, if those positions were to be filled 100% all year long, we would need $217 million. We do have an average statewide vacancy of 4.47%. That equates to just over $9.7 million that is unfunded. We have the parole board, and we also have some lump sum premium pay that is added back in $2.8 million for an overall personal service authorization of $210.4 million. And that's the end of our presentation,
Mr. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So certainly here to entertain questions. We know that in this budget we're asking for a full, what I consider to be a full funding. We have looked at a supplemental. We had a supplemental last year that was close to $10 million. I can tell you where our budget is at this year. It's certainly going to be our supplemental that probably is coming, despite every effort that I have my entire team on full tilt about this budget issue in our department. I can assure you of that, we're going to have a hard time making our budget this year, and I don't know if that's any big surprise to anyone or not. So I think, and I have advocated as the commissioner, that in running these systems, that there should be a full accounting and a full transparency what's going to cost us. And I do not like supplementals. I feel that even for a department like this, I mean, it's when you're running prisons, and I've been in juvenile corrections a long time as well as adult, you have costs that you cannot control. And so that's kind of a given too. But where our budget is at and where I think our budget really needs to be at, and I understand where we're at, believe me. But I think it's only fair that as we wrestle with this, and I know that all of you wrestle with this as well, that we have a fair accounting, that this is kind of what it's probably going to cost us. And if we want to do something different as a policy call, like make a substantial major change to a policy call about what we're doing with our correctional system, then we should kind of be upfront about that, about those difficult decisions that we all make, and I make as commissioner. But I think this really represents a fair assessment of what it's going to cost for us to run the correctional system as it stands for next year. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So we have Representative Grin, Representative Thompson, Representative Newman, and Representative Guttenberg. Now we'll take the list, and Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. few questions. Slide 8 regarding the division of institutions, line 7 at the education and vocational programs. It's a high number of offenders who you serve in that program. Do you have details of what that budget has looked like in the last 3 years, what cuts have done to that budget?
Through the chair to Representative Grin, that budget has remained flat funded for the last 3 years and has not had a decrement to it. I can also, the number of offenders that served, that could be an offender that has received multiple certifications in various programs.
Follow-up for Representative Grin.
Has that number of offenders served increased?
Through the chair to Representative Grin, yes, it has.
Any numbers you can share with the committee on that, or to me at least, would be great. And then on slide.
And Representative Grin, are you wanting like 5 years of?
Since 15.
Okay.
Regarding pretrial services, I know you have a pretty high number of positions not filled. If you'd speak to the trouble you're having with recruiting.
To the chair, Representative Grin, there's several reasons why. On the wrong slide, but there it is. There's several reasons for doing that. One, and we can talk certainly more about it next week. But we knew that the start date for this division was going to be January 1, and we were going to then start the process of doing assessments, providing to the court, knowing that certain people were going to go on supervision, and so we were going to grow this. And so there was no point having 60 employees when you're just starting the system out. It doesn't make sense. The other thing is, you build this, I want to make sure that we're doing the right thing in terms of building it and slowly bringing people on as you train. First of all, standing up 60 people with the capacity of your academy is just impossible. And so the wise way of doing this and being frugal at the same time was to slowly grow this as the division workload increases over time. So the real division workload will be probably a year out, and so that's the reason why. Now, having said that, there are some recruitment, as we all know, and DPS is in the room as well. We all have the same recruitment and retention issues. Right now, we are having people apply and get into the pretrial enforcement division, but the biggest vacancy factor there really was to be wise about how we were advancing the workforce to match the workload, if that makes sense.
So the vacant positions aren't holding you back from standing up as much as you would like to at the moment?
Well, through the chair, Representative Grin, that's essentially correct. We're not having, I think, my director, I'll see if she agrees with me next week. I think if we had a few more staff, she would feel a little bit better. But we're not really outside the scope of where we thought we would be. We're in the ballpark.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Going to slide 11, I think that's just the one you're on, in fact. I was just curious if you break out the transportation cost for people that are in pretrial that are having to go to court. Is that broke out from other transportation costs for prisoners?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, no, the transports are on the other slide, and it's really considered an institutional cost. So if part of that, there may be some small costs, like if we go out and arrest an offender, arrest a pretrial person, there may be some small costs associated with that, but not really. That's really the cost of moving people between cities or things like that is still being borne out in the institutional. So we're really not showing any transportation costs of offenders in this sky, because if someone does violate and we have either a community jail or our pretrial enforcement officers are going and arresting them and bringing them back in. So we haven't really I may be speaking out of turn here with my director. I'm not sure if she has somewhere in the budget, but I haven't identified places in the budget that's really still on the institutional side, and I'm hoping I have that right.
Through the chair, can you clarify your question, Representative Thompson?
Chair, my question was, your big part of your population is people awaiting pretrial. They have to get to trial. That's what I'm referring to is people in jail have to get to pretrial, and is that transportation cost borne by you, or is that the state troopers that take them? And do you break out the differences between moving from one location to another or anything? I mean,
through the chair to Representative Thompson, those are court service officers that are housed within the Department of Public Safety's budget, and they would be better able to speak to that.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Thompson, we do, though, do transports of prisoners back and forth that's currently under institutions, if I understand your question. It's not in this division, but it is in the institution division budget. There is quite a bit of cost with moving prisoners from location, and we do bear some of those costs. Part of those costs are borne out by DPS as well.
Okay. Real quickly, I'm just curious on inmate health care. How much of that is offset by monies coming from their permanent fund dividends?
Through the chair to Representative Thompson, we do receive, I believe it's $11.9 million that's within the FY19 budget that is specifically associated with permanent fund criminal funds. And those are funds that are allocated to the department from those inmates that are ineligible due to being incarcerated, who would have been eligible had they not been incarcerated for that year.
Quick follow-up on that. Out of curiosity, I think that originally that their permanent fund portion that they're supposed to receive, some of that was supposed to have gone to victim restitutions, and is that being broke out according to statutes that were passed a long time ago or not, or how does that fit?
Through the chair to Representative Thompson, I believe, so when the Department of Revenue Division of Permanent Fund identifies the amount that's eligible for allocation, that's given to the Office of Management and Budget, and OMB will first fund the victim's restitution at $1.4 million, I believe, is what they get. And then the remaining amount is allocated to the department's budget.
Thank you.
Representative Newman and then Guttenberg and Pruitt.
Thank you. I just had two quick questions from the chair. Again, with the Victims Compensation Fund.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Again, with the Victims Compensation Fund, I notice on page 5, you have a note there in a bullet box of 18.86. Of 8.6 million UGF replacing PDF criminal funds. I thought a criminal's permanent fund dividend check was garnished by the department, and then that was supposed to go to the workman's comp or the victim's compensation fund. It's been my understanding that those monies were used for operating costs. If you could explain if that was or not, and why we would have to replace UGF with PFD criminal funds.
Through the chair to Representative Newman, the amount that is reallocated by the governor's office that is then put into the governor's budget, as the amount of PFD criminal funds is adjusted up or down, there is a like fund change that is then put into the Department of Corrections budget to be able to maintain a flat amount available for the health care cost of the inmate health care components.
I can get into that further. And just another question is that with Senate Bill 91, we were supposed to see last year, we were presented a reinvestment fund for the funds that were supposed to be the savings for Senate Bill 91. Could you show us in the budget where those savings were spent?
Well, through the chair, Representative Newman, I think that's I'm not sure how to answer that question. Let me just say this. I think there was an anticipation that through this journey, through some of the reform efforts, that we were going to receive more savings. And this is a long answer that I'm trying to make very short. In order to capture those savings, you have to have less inmates in a substantial way, and you have to have less inmates where you can actually close something down. So I don't know the projected savings that we were going to get. I would say is that we haven't seen that, and we haven't, or more likely, what I think is that there was a hopeful expectation placed earlier on, before maybe at the time I came on, that this is where we were going to land, and we haven't landed there. And I think there's
reason. Prison up in Sutton.
And Mr. through the chair, that is in spite of the fact that I did close a prison, and we found savings out of that. But that's still not going to make up for the assumptions that were made of where we were going to be able to close another facility.
Thank you, Representative Gunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm probably going to sound like I'm repeating myself from other departments, but I'm looking for savings that you're not accruing because of an inefficient state system. But in electronic monitoring, what part of that is? And I know you're 48% cost recovery through fees about or internet costs or phone costs, and in probation, statewide probation and parole, how many people are kept in a community with a probation officer that could go home if they had direct monitoring at home through? Just getting back to broadband and internet costs, what we're not saving because we have an inefficient system. So, you know, when you talk about transportation, how many times do you take somebody to a hearing or a court where it's canceled or it takes 2 minutes where they could have done it telephonically or on a conference call or in other ways? I know no other department has an answer. I'm just trying to put it out there how inefficient the state internet system is and how much it costs you.
Well, through the chair, Representative Gutenberg, I'm glad you said no other department has an answer. We are keenly aware that we need video court systems greatly enhanced. We have that in some areas. There's the Attorney General, Department of Public Safety, and myself are on this issue as we speak. It requires some capital investment. But every court hearing that I can avoid moving someone, it is not only cheaper but safer for everyone involved, mostly for the staff, either my staff that are doing the transport or the troopers who are doing the transport who should be out in the field and not transporting prisoners. So this is a area that we continue to work on. I know that's not a very satisfactory answer, but we have made progress in certain areas. We do have video conferencing in Nome right now, going to Kotzebue Court. And there's other areas where we have broken through, but it requires willful effort. It's not easy, and we are making progress, though.
Thank you. I just want to point out that Nome and Kotzebue are on fiber. Thank you.
And Representative,
yeah, well, a lot of questions, but I only have one that I'm going to ask here. And if that's okay, Representative Kopp has actually brought up a point that I was interested if you've analyzed, you've looked into, and it's related to health care costs. What he's the point that he's made is that somewhere in the vicinity, and I apologize, it's 30 to 30-something percent of our inmates, unfortunately, we have a high disposition of Alaska Native inmates. And the point that he's brought up is that is there an opportunity for us to partner with some of the Native health organizations out there in terms of being able to, for them to assist us in providing health care to some of our inmates, recognizing that they have the potential to have some of their costs paid for by federal funds, therefore not only offsetting, but also giving them the ability to be inside the or interacting with some of those inmates and assisting some of their own members. Is that something you guys have analyzed? Is that something that is the potential? And kind of what is the forward thought on doing that if you have looked at it?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the short answer on that is no. There are no. I don't think there's much opportunity. There's my director medical behavioral health is here. And this is something I've pushed back on several times, the very same question, as a matter of fact. The reality is the federal guidelines and the federal statutes under Indian Health Services and Veterans Administration, et cetera, are very prescriptive about if you're inside a prison, we don't cover you. That's the bad news. Here's the good news where I have tried to take this department the last 2 years and where we are going. and I'm hoping a fix is going to be put in play next week that will help me. The real answer on that is providing more flexibility for me as the department to put people out in locations that do not represent a risk, who can be in halfway house environments or CRC environments, and have a broad array of places where people can go, finish out the rest of their sentence, and do it safely and strategically. And we have very few problems with those people towards the end of their sentence. So whether or not they do the sentence in a cell, when they got 6 months to do, or a year, they've already done 7 or 8 years, you can really, the more flexibility I have as a department to put them out in sort of halfway house locations, then many of them do become Medicaid eligible. I know we're still all paying for that, and that, I mean, that's a whole other discussion, but whether or not they're Medicaid expansion, what percentage actually qualifies. But the real hopeful area is to provide more diversity for where people finish their sentence. But unfortunately, and I have asked the director to relook at this entirely again and to talk to Representative Kopp, you as well, if you would prefer, to really go through and really pore over this one more time to see if there's any wiggle room. My unfortunate answer, I think there's not wiggle room in this area. I think the wiggle room is in some other areas where we have, and just so you know, while we only have two people out, I have two people in the queue, and each one of those dialysis patients represents about a $25,000 or $30,000 savings per month for us. So there are certain people that are high cost that we look at, and I have good relationships with my partner, my colleagues around the country. And so we look at that very closely, and I've been pressing very hard about looking at other options. But on that one, I'm not sure there's much ground, but I think there are in some other areas, and I'm interested. That said, I'm willing to look at it all over again one more time with you if we need to.
And thank you. And this is a high level look. If people want to get into this more, they can go to the subcommittee and sit in and pass notes and questions to the subcommittee to do those. I'm sure you'll be able to get into those details there. So thank you very much for the presentation. We'll take a brief meeting while we prepare for the next. And that will be the Department of Public Safety, and we'll take a break. Okay, we'll come back to order. Welcome, and Commissioner, would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, both your administrative service director, and just to let you know, we ran about 10 minutes over there, so this will have been about 3 o'clock. So look at your timing, and would you like to hold any policy questions at the end, just clarifying questions, or do you want questions as you go?
That's up to you, sir.
Okay, we'll hold the policy questions until the end. If there's clarification questions, we'll go ahead and do that. Now, let you schedule your time.
Well, thank you. For the record, my name is Walt Monaghan. I am the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. Seated next to me is my Director of Administrative Services, Kelly Howell. And good, I figured it out. The mission of the department is before you on the particular slide. Basically, there's our constitutional authority that is in link here. It comes from Article 1, Section 12 in the criminal administration. The next two links are from our OMB, and they talk about our budgets and our division measures, and because of the interest of time, I figured that we could examine them later. Also, in the interest of the time and to provide actually more appropriate detail, Director Howell will provide the narrative for the balance of this presentation, though I will be available for questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Howell, and I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Public Safety. Beginning on slide two, the next five slides contain graphs prepared by the Legislative Finance Division. And the one before you now on slide two provides a 10-year look back of the department's general fund budget, which includes both unrestricted general funds and designated general funds. From FY09 to FY19 governor's request, the department's budget grew by $49 million, which is an average annual growth rate of 3.4%. From FY09 through FY14, DPS experienced increases in our general fund budget, with decreases beginning in FY15. The total general fund reduction from FY14 to FY19 governor's request is $7.4 million. Speaking specifically to the department's FY19 governor's request, it's slightly above FY13 levels by approximately $1 million. The general fund category comprises 86% of our overall budget. And of the general fund budget, 95% of it is unrestricted general funds at $163 million. Next slide.
Thank you.
Slide number three. This graph provides a 10-year look back of the department's annual operating budget totals by fund source. Our total FY19 budget request is $199,304,000, which is a 2.7% increase over FY18. And I will be reviewing the department's increment requests as we go through the components in upcoming slides. Unrestricted general funds do comprise 82% of the department's overall budget, with federal funds being 8%. Other funds, which includes funds such as interagency receipts at 6%, and then designated general funds at 4%. Speaking specifically to our FY19 budget request, the department made reductions of nearly $3.8 million, so $3,756,000 in hollow authorization or uncollectible receipt authority in order to more accurately align our budget with our anticipated revenues. Slide number four provides a 10-year look back of the department's annual operating budget by line item for all fund sources. And as is probably similar to most other departments, personal services is the largest percentage of our budget at 57%. I will say that our FY19 budget request includes 804 permanent full-time positions, which is a net decrease of 4 positions from FY18. And a net decrease of 81 permanent full-time positions since FY15. And the budgeted positions that we have in FY19 are at same levels that we had in FY2006. Slide number five provides a 10-year look back of the department's budget by appropriation, including all fund sources. We have 6 appropriations, or RDUs, results delivery units, that make up our budget. And when looking at all fund sources for the FY19 governor's proposed budget, at $131.4 million, the Alaska State Troopers appropriation is the largest share at 66% of our overall budget. It's important to note that the Alaska State Trooper's appropriation includes both the Alaska State Trooper and the Alaska Wildlife Trooper divisions. Slide number six provides a 10-year look back of the department's general fund budget by appropriation. So same slide as the previous, only limited just to general funds. And similar to the previous slide, the Alaska State Troopers appropriation is the largest at 72% of the department's overall general fund, or general fund budget. The next five slides will provide a breakdown of the department by allocation. First being our fire and life safety allocation. The Department of Public Safety is statutorily required to foster, promote, regulate, and develop ways and means of protecting life and property against fire and explosion. And this allocation is where most of that occurs, through the State Fire Marshal's Office. Their statutory mission is to prevent the loss of life and property from fire. They have statewide jurisdiction for fire code enforcement and plan review authority, except in communities that have received deferrals. I will say that this allocation does include an increment in the FY19 budget of $75,000 in unrestricted general funds and $125,000 in designated general funds, so a $200 increment request, to conduct fire safety inspections and for rural firefighter training. The Alaska Fire Standards Council establishes professional standards for fire service personnel and curriculum requirements for the certification of training programs in support of legislative findings under Alaska Statute 1870-320. Our special projects allocation is comprised primarily of federal funds for special projects, such as public safety services within the Chugach and Tongass National Forests through U.S. Forest Service contracts, overtime costs associated with participation in federal task forces through the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, and our domestic violence and sexual assault training for law enforcement through the U.S. DOJ Office of Violence Against Women. Our Alaska Bureau of Highway Patrol, the troopers within this allocation help maintain the safety of Alaska's highways through targeted enforcement of speeding violations, distracted and impaired drivers, as well as other driver behaviors that contribute to serious injury and fatal crashes. Our Judicial Services Bureau positions budgeted in this allocation are primarily court services officers. And this is the component that conducts most of our prisoner transports throughout Alaska. They provide security for Alaska's courts and court facilities. They protect the judiciary, and they provide timely service of legal process. And our prisoner transportation component, there are actually no positions budgeted in this allocation. The allocation funds the transportation of prisoners needing pre-arraignment or post-arraignment escorts, as well as transport of convicted prisoners between in-state facilities. There's a little bit of funding in the other category, which is interagency receipts to transport individuals with mental health issues from their communities to either the Alaska Psychiatric Institute or to a community with a hospital providing local designated treatment and evaluation services. So those fundings come through the Department of Health and Social Services. Search and rescue. This allocation supports search and rescue operations for the recovery of lost or missing persons, and it's used to reimburse public and private organizations for the resources spent during search and rescue operations. So there are no employees actually budgeted under this allocation. The resources are also coordinated with the rescue coordination components of the Alaska National Guard and the U.S. Coast Guard. Under rural trooper housing, the department operates state housing in support of our statutory responsibilities, and we charge rent consistent with the applicable collective bargaining agreement or with competitive market conditions if it's not addressed within the collective bargaining agreement. Rent that is actually paid by the troopers staying in state housing is deducted from their payroll and deposited into this allocation. We currently have 63 housing units located in rural Alaska, where housing is traditionally scarce, and it helps us to have troopers based in those communities. 14 of those properties are state-owned, and 49 are leased throughout 20 communities. Our statewide drug and alcohol enforcement unit, as the component title states, these troopers investigate trafficking of both controlled substances and illegal alcohol throughout the state. With respect to the AST detachments allocation, this is the department's largest, both in terms of budget and personnel. So it covers all of the trooper posts across our five geographic detachments. So your basic troopers, this is where most of them are budgeted in. And those services include patrol, enforcement, and search and rescue areas all across the state. This allocation does include an increment request in the FY19 budget of $2 million in unrestricted general funds to expand our ability to conduct more proactive policing and enhance the level of service provided, primarily in rural Alaska. And I should mention that the increments that we're asking for in the FY19 budget are primarily associated with the Governor's Public Safety Action Plan. Our Alaska Bureau of Investigation, this particular unit focuses on major crime investigations, including homicides and sexual assaults, and in providing investigative assistance to other law enforcement agencies across the state. The allocation does include an increment request of $570,000 in unrestricted general funds to add two non-permanent trooper investigator positions that will be embedded in the Department of Law and provide vital follow-up investigative activities for domestic violence, sexual assault, and sexual abuse of minor cases. The Alaska Wildlife Troopers component, this is where the bulk of our Alaska Wildlife Troopers are budgeted, and they perform statewide patrol of commercial big game services, commercial fisheries, sport fish and sport fish guiding, game and trapping. They provide enforcement and education regarding boating safety and in safeguarding habitat through reduction of watershed damage and noncompliance with environmental permits. The AWT, or Alaska Wildlife Trooper Aircraft Section, maintains the fleet of department aircraft and provides aircraft services for prisoner transports, search and rescue missions, emergency response, and basic law enforcement patrols. The allocation does include an increment request in the FY19 governor's budget of $570,000 to add two permanent full-time aircraft pilot positions to provide a broader level of service to rural Alaska. The two additional positions would enable the department to staff both our complex fixed-wing aircraft, which is the King Air 350, and our primary search and rescue helicopters, the A-STARS, nearly 7 days per week. The Alaska Wildlife Troopers Marine Section maintains the fleet of department's vessels for search and rescue missions, emergency response, and basic law enforcement patrols. Our VPSO program allocation, funds from this allocation are granted out to 10 organizations to hire village public safety officers and to administer the program within their region. The Alaska Police Standards Council allocation is 100% supported with general fund program receipts through the Alaska Police Training Fund. The fund is comprised of surcharges on fines that are associated with criminal offenses and violations. I'll note that the administration has introduced House Bill 294, which proposes to increase by 100% the surcharge amounts imposed for a defendant who pleads guilty to, forfeits bail, or is convicted of a felony offense, misdemeanor offense, or a violation. And should funds from the Alaska Police Training Fund continue to be appropriated to the Alaska Police Standards Council, that would result, obviously, in an increase in their ability to provide training to law enforcement across the state. Our Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault provides for planning and coordination of services to victims of domestic violence or sexual assault and to their families, and also to perpetrators of domestic violence and sexual assault. They also provide crisis intervention and prevention programs. This allocation includes a increment request for increased federal receipt authority in the amount of $4 million, and that is based on a growth in the federal grant received by the council from the Victims of Crime Act. On slide 10, the Commissioner's Office allocation funds the Commissioner's Office staff and includes the Department's Office of Professional Standards. This allocation does include a funding request, one-time funding request, of $150,000 in unrestricted general funds to conduct a feasibility study for purposes of determining whether creating state-managed centralized dispatch centers would benefit the state more than the existing structure. Our Public Safety Training Academy, which is located in Sitka, provides initial and continuing law enforcement training to troopers, state fire marshals, court service officers, park rangers, airport police, municipal law enforcement agencies, and village public safety officers. The administrative services allocation provides centralized administrative support for the other divisions within the department in the areas of finance, general administration, budget, grants administration, procurement, and supply management. The Alaska Wing Civil Air Patrol, funding in this allocation is appropriated by the legislature to the Department of Public Safety and is passed directly through to the Alaska Wing Civil Air Patrol as the state's contribution in support of the Civil Air Patrol's mission. The Civil Air Patrol currently uses the funds to pay operating costs for the Lake Hood aircraft maintenance facility and also maintains 12 existing hangars. The department does work with the Civil Air Patrol on search and rescue missions, and the department does also access use of some of the hangars that are maintained by the Civil Air Patrol. So there's a mutually beneficial relationship there. Our information systems allocation contains the department's information technology section, which provides programming and support for the state's critical criminal justice information systems. Our criminal justice information systems program is actually a new allocation. The previous allocation of information systems and CGIS programs were one allocation last budget cycle the past several years. It was the statewide information technology services allocation. We have split this component into both information technology and then the CGIS programs allocation to better align the services or differentiate, I should say, the services that each of those allocations provides, and also due to the administration's consolidation of information technology through the Office of Information Technology Services. What the CGIS program, or the Criminal Justice Information Systems Program allocation does is they provide and maintain centralized information pertaining to state criminal history records, fingerprints, and sex offenders. They conduct process server and security guard licensing. They administer the concealed handgun permit program, and they're responsible for collecting, tabulating, reporting, and publishing the uniform crime report data that's provided by state and local law enforcement agencies, and then submitting that information to the FBI for inclusion in national crime statistic reports. This allocation includes an increment request in the FY19 budget of $595,000 to add six new permanent full-time positions to establish a records and classification unit in preparation for the FBI's transition to a new reporting system for crime statistics, moving from summary-based or UCR reporting to incident-based or NIBRS, which is the National Incident-Based Reporting System format. This new format requires much more detail and intricacies in reporting. So this unit would allow this unit would actually review law enforcement case reports for completeness, accuracy, and consistency under the new NIBRS format, which will ultimately allow for more timely and robust crime statistics reporting, and hopefully provide better data for policymaking. Additionally, the allocation includes a request for $1 million in increased federal receipt authority based on a new federal grant that the this particular component received for NIBRS compliance. So NIBRS, again, being National Incident-Based Reporting System. The funding that was received from the U.S. Department of Justice was to prepare our information systems for this new reporting format that was being implemented by the FBI. So the federal funding side was to do the programming, and we're asking for the operating budget increment to staff the unit that will actually perform the work. Our laboratory services allocation performs forensic services across the state for law enforcement agencies. They also provide expert court testimony on the results of tested evidence. They train law enforcement officers in proper evidence collection and on evidence preservation techniques, and they administer the statewide breath alcohol program. And then facility maintenance is represents annual expenditures for scheduled and preventative maintenance to keep our facilities operational and in a continuous state of readiness. And the state facilities rent allocation represents the public building fund rent that's paid to the Department of Administration for our Juneau Public Safety Building. Slide number 12 is a represents the trend in healthcare costs for the department from FY 2014 to proposed FY 2019. It's remained relatively stable across the 5 years, with FY19 reflecting 8.2% of our budget being dedicated to health care costs. I can say that the department does take the health and wellness of its employees very seriously, particularly our troopers and court service officers and deputy fire marshals who are out doing work that is both physically and mentally demanding. So with some of the efforts that we have taken to ensure the health and wellness of our employees, as well as to hopefully reduce health care costs, include establishing a voluntary wellness program. We've had that in effect for a year, since January of 2017. And the program incentivizes employees to take part in general health activities such as annual physical exams, health screenings, including blood tests for vitamin D levels, thyroid, metabolic panels, stress management activities, and oral and eye health examinations. So we incentivize our employees by providing administrative leave to participate in those activities. And in addition, the department shares information as received through the Union Health Trusts and the Department of Administration, sharing that information with employees as it's available. Mr. Chairman, that concludes our presentation, and we would be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Well, thank you. And no. Would you go back to slide 7? And under the Alaska Bureau of Highway Patrol, the rating effectiveness is ineffective. Can you discuss that briefly?
Mr. Chair, that the original setup of the Alaska Bureau of Highway Patrol had us staffed with about 21 troopers, I believe, 21 or 22. And since the last few years, the last few budget cycles, we have reduced that number from that down to about, I think we have three troopers that are on the road, and there's other individuals that support some of the grants that have to come through that. But the fact that we had reduced it by reallocating the troopers that were in it from a specialized to a generalized patrol, we really can't say that the three that we have that are currently out there, they're that effective.
So are you thinking about reallocating or getting rid of that designation and putting all the troopers back to generalized troopers if this is ineffective?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that was what we want to do at this time. I think that we still need to maintain a presence, because we still receive some federal grants that we share and cooperate with other local entities like the Anchorage Police or the Palmer and Wasilla, especially on the designated safety corridors. So it is something that we want to take, and at some point when we actually can build our staff back up, which is another hearing, we want to go ahead and staff that.
Thank you. Questions? Director Ortiz and Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you recall last fall or sometime in the last session, we were talking about the issue of unfilled positions for troopers. Can you give us an update on that and tell us what the department, what kind of incentives, what's happening to try to address that issue?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, actually we're going to have a hearing, I believe, on Thursday morning to really go in depth in that.
In
so,
the subcommittee?
Yes. Yes, sir. So, but in a brief overview, we have put together a plan, and I think that plan will be a little bit more robust and a little more detailed when we have more time.
Okay. Follow-up? Thank you. Not part of that subcommittee, but I wanted to specifically raise that question because it was brought to my attention just recently here by a constituent who works in the public safety field that the issue of unfilled positions from his perspective, would be a growing problem, and mainly what we're seeing across the state in all public safety areas is a hiring away of our people to other locations. Can you speak to that at all?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I can. And that perspective that was shared with you is pretty much generalized amongst a lot. We find that not only in our troopers that we have gotten trained, but we're even seeing it in our VPSOs, where they're being hired away for more lucrative, maybe more money or more enhanced benefits, for example. That is part of the plan that we're trying to work in to counteract that. There's going to be several components. Some of them are going to – they will be presented on Thursday morning. And for everything that we can do to try to retain at least five of our current staff, it's like saving $1 million for us. So it's crucial. It's crucial for the public safety, for the state. And I think that what we do have is going to take a little bit of while to get that momentum start to shift. You heard it from Commissioner Williams that everyone is having a difficult time in retaining, recruiting and retaining. This is a national problem across the country for a variety of reasons, and we're trying to tackle it in the best way that we possibly can, given all the restraints that we are currently faced with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and congratulations for remembering to say vitamin D in your overview of your health care. So I have a question concerning the difference between the trooper detachments, which are considered constitutionally required, and the VPSOs, which aren't. Even though they have different or similar functions, they're still required under public safety of the state of Alaska. So can you talk about how they're not the same?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that the VPSO program was created about 40 years ago, and it was created basically to supplement the Alaska State Troopers because we had so many more communities that did not have any form of law enforcement at all. Most police departments, and ours included, we have to combat two different things. One is crime itself, but The second thing is fear of crime, which can be just as devastating to a community. So having individuals out there who can function in addressing low-level crime or disorder issues is still better than having no one at all. And I think the biggest support any kind of testimonial way for the VPSOs would actually come from the villages themselves. We hear that all the time, some of them even in the local area. They want VPSOs, they need them, and because they understand that we don't have enough troopers to go around.
So if I may, I'd like to readdress that. I don't see why they both don't come under the public welfare. So I understand the troopers, you know, have a constitutional requirement under the clauses in the Constitution for public safety and welfare. Why, even though we can't have troopers, why wouldn't they be considered a constitutional requirement, even though we set them up legislatively at a different time?
Through the chair, Representative Gutenberg, that probably is best answered by when they were first conceived about 40 years ago. They were not necessarily primarily law enforcement, but they were primarily trained to be as in first aid, search and rescue efforts, low-level crime addressing kind of things, as well as fire prevention. So they were kind of a generalized public safety individual. And over the years, with the complications of society, they have now become more and more of a law enforcement entity than they were previously designed to be. We are escalating and have improved their training, and they are now attending the trooper academies, but still it is a situation I think that it's evolving, and time will tell what communities and the state can do together. I think there's still a place for VPSOs in many communities. Many communities enjoy their VPSOs, and but I think that this is going to be an ongoing dialogue with tribes, I think, for a while. And I'm hoping that we can come up with something that satisfies the needs and expenses of everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grimm, then Guerra, and then Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 10, two quick questions regarding the Civil Air Patrol. You mentioned that was a kind of a pass-through grant that the state sends on to them. Do you know what that represents as a percentage of the Civil Air Patrol's budget?
Representative Gren, through the chair, I don't. I would be happy to ask that question of the Civil Air Patrol. We actually aren't aware of what their total budget is or where they get a majority of their funding. They are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. They're an auxiliary arm of the U.S. Air Force. So we could certainly get that information for you and get back to you.
Great. And then regarding the Public Safety Training Academy, you know the total number of it's not just recruits, but it's also it's ongoing training, things like that. Do you know the number of total people served during the course of a year? And is that other funding source, is that paid through from municipalities or fees?
Representative Gren, through the chair, I can address the latter part of your question. The other is it is receipt authority for the training academy to receive fees from local law enforcement or even self-paying individuals that want to attend the academy. We do allow for that, provided that they pass the requisite backgrounds. Regarding the first part, yes, the academy does run two Alaska Law Enforcement Training Academies a year, and then they provide, you know, recertification training and ongoing training throughout the year during the times when there's not the ALIT or the Alaska Law Enforcement Training Academy. But in terms of numbers, I know the training academy has that information, and we can easily get it for you. I don't know it off the top of my head, so, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then we have Representative Guerra and then Thompson.
Thank you. Commissioner, thank you for your service. I also have a question about the VPSO program, which is at this point, There was an effort a number of years ago by Governor Parnell to say every village should have a public safety officer, and that hasn't happened, and it's difficult to hire them. I guess what is, just briefly, what is your plan for getting officers to those villages, and how many communities, I think it was communities over 25 people, how many communities don't have a public safety officer under the, what was the Parnell plan, if you know?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think that to answer the first part of the question is that we are, just last week, we had a VPSO coordinator meeting, and the head of it is a Captain Andrew Merrill. He's been our coordinator for VPSOs for the last couple of years. And what they are going to experiment with is embedding a VPSO within our recruiting team, so that when we travel with our recruiters, there's also going to be a VPSO that'll travel with the same recruiters, trying to woo more people into filling these vacancies and providing that kind of service. In regards to how many communities, I think we have me without my windows. Correct. Currently, we're serving about 44 communities with VPSOs. And trying to get more, again, we are working with the grantees on that, because VPSOs are employees of the grantees, in ways of looking at different way in recruiting, in retention. There's the discussion perhaps of even going on to the two-on, two-off, like we do in some of the posts that we have a difficult time trying to fill otherwise. So, again, it's a evolving situation. To get to where we can get one in every community, that will be years down the line, I would suspect, sir.
And before we go to Representative Thompson, I wanted to ask, I was just informed that one of the problems is that you don't allow, or the money is not allowed that goes to the VPS program to be used for recruiting. So is that the case, or is that anyway, you can consider that and get back to me. We're really running out of time, so I'll go to Representative Thompson. But if you would get back to us on mechanisms that you're looking at to improve the flexibility in the VPSO, what those roadblocks are for filling those positions.
Through the chair, to the chair. Actually, in some cases, we are relaxing the unspent money or the lapse money to help in recruiting efforts. So that's a short answer.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Commissioner, I want to thank you for the work you do with the public opinion that's out there about the public safety at this time and the troopers. My question is kind of like a little different. On page 8, I see there's a shortage of about 43 trooper detachment people, 12 state trooper detachment, another 3 for Bureau of Investigation, and 3 more in the Alcohol Drug Enforcement Unit. That's over 60 shortage. I assume that most of those positions have a vehicle assigned to them. Do we have a whole fleet of vehicles that are kind of in storage waiting for somebody to be hired?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, I'd have to take a pass on that and check for that. But I understand that we order the cars when they need replacement. Where vehicles, in fact, we just had one in Fairbanks that was involved in an accident. But let me research that one and get back to you, if I may.
And one short follow-up.
Very short.
A few years ago, we unfunded the helicopter pilot position in Fairbanks. Is that back online? Is that helicopter setting stored right now? What's going on?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, that aircraft is back online. We put it back there, and it's functioning out of Fairbanks. In fact, it's being used today.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we do need to go to the next presentation. Do you have a
Good. Yeah, thank you. I will add to your question, Mr. Chair. So would you get back to, with Representative Seaton, the chairman, on VPSOs and restrictions on their grant funds, not just being used for recruitment, but my impression is they can't use money for anything but salaries. They can, you're allowed to use unspent money on troopers, on housing, and other things that enhance the ability to hire troopers, but the recipients that get money for VPSOs can't use unspent money for anything except salaries. They can't enhance housing or remodel or do any of that stuff. If you can get back with me at the same with Representative Seaton's question.
Through the chair, Representative Gutenberg, actually, we do. We do really, we're always available to be approached by the grantees, and we do get a number of requests, some of which we approve. So but we'll get you the complete answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. We'll take a brief at ease while we get the Department of Natural Resources presentation up. And the department's personnel can come on up to the table. Meeting back to order, and welcome. And would you go ahead and put yourselves on the record?
I'm Heidi Hansen, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Natural Resources.
And I am Mark Wiggin, Deputy Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources.
Good afternoon. Fabian Peter-Contest, Director of Support Services for the Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for having us this afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon, and before we start, I think we'll just go ahead and make the decision. If there's clarifying questions from the committee, we can clarify something, but for policy, we'll wait until the end. And we have a little bit after 3:30, so we have a half hour presentation, so if you could go ahead and use your time the way you'd like there.
Great, thanks very much.
One thing, we have two female voices up there, so if you switch, just say your first name in your introduction each time you.
All right. This is Fabian Peter-Contest, Director of Support Services. We are presenting today a very high-level overview of the Department of Natural Resources budget. In the committee's packets, we've also provided you with the DNR program guide, which is an in-depth look at every single program that we're going to be discussing here today if you want more information. The financial information in the program guide is from FY18 management plan, so it's current year. Doesn't quite line up with 19Gov. The Department of Natural Resources, obviously, I'm not going to read everything on the screen, so you've seen much of this before, but our four main core services, we have been focused since the FY15 budget forward on really paring down any program that is not specifically related to our core services, and we eliminated some and we have pared down or trimmed any other program that's not core service specific. Our overall budget for 19 is $152 million. We are down approximately 15% since 2015. Our UGF budget, unrestricted general fund, is about $58.7 million. That's 39% of our budget. And that is down 33% from FY15. Our designated general fund budget is $33 million approximately. It's about 22% of our budget, and we have increased our program receipt budget by about 24% over the last 3 years. And I'll talk a little bit more about our focusing on the revenue that we generate and using those receipts for the operations of their department a little further on down the road. The other category, which is some of our statutory designated program receipts, interagency receipts, capital improvement projects, et cetera, it's about 23% of our budget, and we're down 15% in the last 3 years. Excuse me, 4 years. And federal, we've increased about 15% over the last, since FY15, to about $25 million. Positions are down from, we're down 207 positions in the last, since FY15. We currently have 900 PCNs, and we've taken about 19% cut in positions since that high year of FY15. So this legislative finance division graph, you're probably really familiar with all these graphs by now, having heard many of these presentations. This is general fund only. That's designated general funds and unrestricted general funds. You can see the high in 15, and a lot of that, about $10 million of that, was the AKLNG project. It drops quite a bit in 16 because that project was recategorized as in-state pipeline funds and an other category. We have steadily decreased our general funds. You'll see the bump in 18. That is an increase of reappropriated capital funds for the A-STAR project, and that is a multi-year operating project, so you'll see the big bump. It doesn't show up in governor's adjusted budget yet. It'll show up in management plan next year. There are two things that are not included in our budget that have been included in this slide, and that is adjustments made by Legislative Finance Division. The first one is boating receipts have always been categorized as other. And in the 19 governor's adjusted budget, they have been recategorized as designated general funds. That's $300,000 of boating receipts. The other addition is we have had contingency language in our budget for the past 3, 4, 5 years. I'm not exactly sure how long, for fire crew. If we do not receive federal funds for fire crew, there's a contingency language that we can get general funds for those crew. We've never used that money. We've never used the language, not to date. But because the federal funding for fire is pretty volatile, we like to keep it in there. Legislative finance, because they want to see very transparent, we all want to see very transparent budgeting. The potential for us asking for that money is there, so it's included, and you'll see a little increase in our budget of $1.125 million because of that contingency language. Our general fund has decreased overall about $6.8 million since 2009. We have decreased our UGF about 21%. Since 2015. Our DGF, however, our general fund program receipts, has increased quite a bit, and that's because we have, as I mentioned before, we've tried to increase our reliance on program receipts that we generate, revenue we generate, and decrease our reliance on the unrestricted general fund. Those are areas that we collect receipts are, for instance, park passes, parking, public use cabins, mineral sales on the North Slope, mining leases, many, many categories of revenue. We have put new fees in place currently for the sale of seismic data. So we're looking for ways to increase revenue and find new revenue, not necessarily rely on the revenue that we're already generating. And to date, since our revenue went into since those fees went into place, we've collected about $130,000 for seismic data sales, and we have maybe 160, 170 in the works. That's very initial data that we have available. We expect quite a bit more to be available in FY19. The other new fee regulations that we are looking for in FY19, we expect to be in place. Our fee changes for parks, Division of Parks and Division of Mining, Land and Water, Parks and Division of Mining, Land and Water. The fee new regulations should be out by FY19 at the latest. So we'll be looking to use some of the increased revenue from those fees. Overall, we have about $1.7 million in fund source changes in 19, and I want to make it clear that those fund source changes aren't from existing revenue that we're generating, but that's from new revenue that we project from these new fee packages. Okay. So you're familiar, I'm sure, with the slide that shows all funds, and this is by line item. Department of Natural Resources, bulk of our expenditures is in personal services. Even though we have reduced our PCN count from 1,095 in 2009 down to 900 in FY19, you'll see that our costs have still gone up. The average cost of a PCN in 2009 was $75,000, and the average cost of a PCN in 2019 is estimated at $98,000. Most of that, all if not all of that, is outside of our control. Much of it is bargaining unit agreements for cost of living increases. We'll talk a little bit about healthcare cost increases and other bargained personal services costs. Since FY15, as I mentioned, we have reduced about 19% of our staffing. The other bulk of our expenditures is in the contractual line. We spend quite a bit of money on firefighting, obviously, air tanker contracts, helicopter contracts, flying field surveys for data collection in the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. We have core services costs that we pay for in terms of leases, Office of Information Technology, risk management, human resources, et cetera. So the bulk is in personal services and contractual. Our travel expenditures have steadily gone down since FY15. And if I just looked yesterday at our actuals for 15, 16, and 17, and between those 3 years, we're down 40% in our actual travel expenditures. If you leave fire activity out of that, much of the fire activity expenditures for travel is, for one, outside of our control, and the second part of that is much of it is federally reimbursed. Again, we're back to general fund only, so designated general funds and general fund or unrestricted general fund. This is by results delivery unit, or RDU. The green line represents Division of Mining, Land and Water, Division of Forestry, fire activity and fire preparedness, and forest management in that division, and the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. You'll notice the uptick in starting in about FY12 when we received some funding to work on our permitting backlog. Some increases through FY15 and then again going down after our high in FY15. On the far right, you'll see an uptick, that last green dot or triangle. That again is the $1,125,000 fire crew contingency increase. As I mentioned before, we have the bump in the blue line, which is the A-STAR program, $7.3 million in reappropriated funds from a capital project that is a multi-year operating. The previous bump in FY15, that spike was for the AKLNG project. All of the other lines are going steadily down. We do have a little bump in Division of Oil and Gas in 19, and we do have a small increment in FY19 to cover some projects that I'll discuss later that were previously covered in the capital budget. And again, all funds by results delivery unit, fairly straightforward. Fire language, again, is that top green line showing it's going up. We did privatize the Mount McKinley Meat and Sausage Plant in FY18, so that shows a decrease. And the other thing that we have done overall to decrease our budget in 19 is we have eliminated about $2.4 million in empty authority across federal, interagency receipts, SDPR, statutory designated, capital improvement projects, et cetera. So we really did scrub the budget to make sure that the right amount of appropriation or allocation is in each of our divisions. You'll see some increases and decreases across each of those divisions, but overall it's a net $2.4 million reduction in those empty in empty authority. So before we get started on the divisions, and don't worry, I'm not going to read through every one of these. I just want to give you an overview, just a higher level idea of how we approach this. Obviously, we have every single program outlined with the funding source categories, budgeted positions versus filled, and so forth. You understand, you've seen the criteria for the importance to the mission from the chair's memo to us all. Each of these programs is outlined in the program guide for more specific information about what we do, and we'll delve into much of this with our subcommittee, so I'm not going to go into each line. But I do want to talk a little bit about positions. The data here is as of 12/15/17. And as has been mentioned by other directors before me at this table, that's a point in time. So at this point in time, we had 81 positions vacant out of our 908, which we have in 18. As of today, we have, of those 81, there are only 5 that are truly being held open for to meet vacancy factor, because we've met vacancy factor or we're planning on meeting vacancy factor in other ways. We have many, many positions that we've already filled out of that 81. We have positions that are in recruitment right now. Some are being reclassified through the Division of Personnel. The other piece about our positions is every single position that is vacated first is analyzed by each division director to make sure that what we're doing, and do we need to fill the position? And then the next thing that happens is that goes to the commissioner's office with our justification for this is why this position is critical to fill. So we're always evaluating whether we leave a position open, whether we decide not to fill it, restructure our components or our programs, and then it's approved or disapproved by the commissioner's office. So that's our internal process in DNR.
five positions that are being held open because you're meeting your vacancy factor. Yeah. To meet your vacancy factor, because you don't have funding to fill those positions.
Chairman Seaton, yes, that's correct. That is as of today. Tomorrow we may have 10 positions that are vacated, and we look and we go, we reanalyze, and we say, oh, we've got to leave these three open for another 3 or 4 months to make sure that we have enough funding to cover all our positions. So,
just for clarifying on that, I think I just heard that we're justifying adding additional PCNs to clarify the cost of personnel, when I think the legislature, if they reduced the amount of money going into the personnel, that was the intent.
Representative Newman, through the chair, I'm not sure I understood the question.
You know, I thought I heard that they were adding PCNs to cover their additional costs.
No.
And keeping them open.
The question was, they didn't have enough funding to fill those positions. So anyway, during the subcommittee process, would you make sure that it's clarified exactly how the vacancy factor that you're doing and how you're maintaining the budget by having to leave positions open or not, or what that's been like over the last year?
Yes, Chairman Seaton, we will. Thank you. So starting in on the Department or Division of Agriculture, the Division of Agriculture has 9 programs, 33 PCNs. They've seen 25% reduction in unrestricted general funds since 2015, and they've eliminated 12 positions, or 27% of their positions. While they have no increments or significant decrements in FY19, there is a new program that we're looking, that we've put in place in the 19 budget, which is the State Agricultural Veterinarian, which is funded by funds that are being moved in from different areas within the Division of Agriculture. So it's not a funding increment, nor are we requesting new positions. And we have a very specific overview planned for Division of Agriculture in our subcommittee on the 14th of February. The Division of Mining, Land, and Water.
Just to make sure everybody knows that the subcommittee schedules and what's scheduled for those meetings are posted online so people can find them. Make sure they can follow those. The presentations they want, as well as all of the subcommittees are being carried out in rooms with legislative TV, so those are being filmed. I guess we'll say filmed when we're talking digital, but they're archived as well. So I just want to make sure that all members know that if they don't get the information here, they can go on to either to the subcommittee itself or watch it on legislative TV.
So the Division of Mining, Land, and Water is our largest division with 18 programs and 206 positions. You'll see 23 vacant positions as of the 15th of December. Currently, out of those positions, either they are filled, they're in recruitment, or they're part of budget cuts in FY19 and will remain vacant for the rest of the year. Or they're in the Division of Personnel for classification. So we're actively trying to fill all those positions. They've seen a significant UGF reduction since 2015, 66%. But this is the division which has generated significant revenue for the state of Alaska. And we have, over the past several years, done large fund source changes. And their DGF has increased 72%. In FY19, we're looking at another $1 million of fund source change, but again, I I reiterate that this is a fund source change from new revenue. This is not revenue that is currently over collected and lapsing to the general fund. So it is a net positive for the general fund, assuming we collect the revenue in 19. In mining, land, and water, we're reducing UGF in 19 by $532,000 and three PCNs, and again, that $1 million fund source change. And there are two pages of their 18 programs, which you can delve into a little deeper, should you like to. On page 10, the Division of Forestry, three components, nine programs. This is our firefighting, two of our firefighting components, fire preparedness and fire activity, and our forest management component. They had significant reductions up until last year, so 36% of their UGF was cut in forest management specifically, 31% reduction in PCNs. And in 19, we are not proposing any cuts in the governor's budget for the Division of Forestry. All of the vacancies, 21 vacancies currently, as of the 15th of December, are either seasonal fire positions, which will fill, or they are currently being recruited, or they've been filled since the December 15th. This particular graph, since it was created before this table, before Ledge Finance gave me the graphs, does not include the $1.125 million in fire contingency language. So if you're doing the math and don't see it in here, that's because it was not included. Office of Project Management and Permitting, they have five programs. And they've had a 9% UGF reduction since 2015. They've eliminated five positions. And in FY19, we are have a $47,000 UGF cut in this component. Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, two components. We have six programs within there. 52% UGF reduction since FY15, and a 17% increase in designated general funds or their program receipts. Parks is also another division who has been increasingly relying on the revenue they generate and looking for ways to increase that revenue. They've eliminated 25 positions since FY15, and the major change in the budget for 19 is a $500,000 fund source change from new revenue that will be that we anticipate collecting once we get the new fee regulations in place before 19 starts. The boating safety fund source change, which I mentioned before, this is a change from other to DGF, is not included in these dollar amounts. Again, I didn't have that information when these were created. Support Services Division, kind of the back end functions of the department plus the recorder's office. We have three components. We've had a 5% UGF reduction since 2015, but we had 24% reduction in designated general funds in the recorder's office during that period. You may recall that we have had significant cuts in that program, yet it's a program that generates revenue. The cuts have not reduced the revenue that we generate in recording fees. So that has been a positive impact to the general fund. Overall, we have reduced positions by about 62 since FY15. Most of those positions, 27 positions were deleted out of these three components. We transferred positions to Shared Services of Alaska, and we've transferred 25 positions to the Office of Information Technology, although we still have the budget to pay for those positions in these components. We are proposing one cut to this, to the information resource management component, and it's a 50,000 UGF cut plus some other funds and one position. The other a group of other components, which include the commissioner's office, our public information center, which is a one-stop shop for the public to come and pay for their leases to get information about all the programs that we have. We have location in Fairbanks and Anchorage. The EVOS Trustee Council projects, which is part of the Office of Project Management and Permitting, the Mental Health Land, Trust Land Office, the Facilities Maintenance component, and the Interdepartmental Chargebacks component. The major reduction in all of this, in all of these components, is we have a $125,000 cut in the Facilities Maintenance component as a result of our savings from consolidating one floor of the Atwood building. And we've eliminated our footprint on one floor of the Atwood building in Anchorage. So big project, just finished up, significant shuffling of staff, and really pleased with the savings that we're able to find, and opened up space for other state agencies to move into a state-owned building. Division of Oil and Gas, 10 programs. They've had 17% cut in UGF since 2015, and they've had 28 positions, or 22% cut in their PCNs. We are not proposing any cuts for Division of Oil and Gas this year, although we do have two increments, which were should be expected. $250,000 one-time item, an increment. This is for reservoir studies, contractual services, and a $250,000 increment to the base budget for reservoir studies software licensing. These two items have been paid for out of the capital budget in the last for many years. They're more appropriate in the operating budget, and the capital budgets they were swept. The majority of the capital budget was swept in 18. We have enough in the capital budget for this year to cover these costs, but it will need to go in the operating budget to continue this work. And last.
Reverend Pruitt.
Yeah, just can you repeat that before? I got the sweeping, but what were the ones that were being, what were they for?
There's two pieces for reservoir studies on the North Slope. So $250,000 is for contractual services to do the reservoir studies. We also have highly technical and expensive software that we maintain for our staff in oil and gas to assist with these reservoir studies, and the software licensing is $250,000 a year. So the contract, the contractual work is a one-time item just for FY19, and the reservoir studies software licensing is a base budget increment. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt. And the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, 7 programs, significant reductions, 36% since 2015. They've eliminated 11 positions, and the only change we're proposing in the budget for DGGS is a $200,000 fund source change from new revenue from seismic data sales. So you're familiar with the five-year healthcare trends graph. A couple things I'd like to point out. In the top right-hand corner, you can see our employer health contributions. UGF is down $2.4 million since FY14. The main reason for that is our fund sources have changed significantly. Where we were approximately 48% funded by UGF, now we're closer to 38% funded, so obviously our funding sources are going to change for that. One area we have a lot of, not a lot, but significant control over is the workers' compensation numbers. And we've reduced our workers' comp charges by approximately $500,000 over the last 5 years. You probably noticed that public safety, corrections, DOT, and DNR have the highest workers' comp rates. We have people in the field. We have high-risk jobs. So we're pretty proud of the fact that we maintain a fairly healthy firefighting crew. They do quite a bit of training, physical fitness, making sure that their safety training is up to date, to maintain as much, you know, to keep our employees safe. Just interesting to see that we've held steady in terms of total percentage of the budget between 14 and 19. Also, I just looked at the total percent of personal services budget, again, 16%, and then average cost approximately per position, and I just looked at permanent full-time and permanent part-time positions, approximately $16,000 to $17,000 a year per employee. Commissioner's office, the commissioner and the division directors and the department leadership support the health of our employees. There are efforts underway to there's always efforts underway to give people time off for physical fitness. There are team events that people join up to go support the American Heart Association races or whatever, you know, whatever function is going on in the local communities. State Parks has quite a few opportunities to get outside, which is supported by the agency. Looking at flexible work schedules to get out and do those kinds of things. Walking groups, healthy eating groups, definitely are part of our culture of Department of Natural Resources. So with that, that concludes our presentation and obviously open for questions.
And before we go to a few questions, we did have a request if you're, where you were reading off your paperwork that you're reading off all the numbers, if those are in a format that you can provide the committee, that was a request.
Certainly.
Thank you. Representative Thompson, then Gutler, and then Grover.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Back in 2012, questions were asked about what kind of a pile of permits are backlogged and waiting to be issued. And at that time, there was over 800. And the legislature felt that every time, most of the time, when a permit is issued, somebody goes to work, and that was their priority. So we added like $3.8 million back in 2012. A few years later, we've asked the question, how are you doing on catching up? And I think they, instead of 800, they said that most of them were current, but they had about 200 applications on hand. Where are we today? I didn't hear that in case I missed it.
Representative Thompson, through the chair, I believe the current number is 938, and I believe the backlog at the time was in the 2000s. And I'm not sure about the complete number back in 2012. I did talk to Director Brent Goodrum just a few days ago about this. We, as of December, I think it was 938. Interestingly, the prior year was about the same number. It was a little higher, maybe 950. So while we did get a bump, and we did get a bump in the budget, and we did decrease the backlog significantly, as we have sustained additional cuts, we're holding steady. We are decreasing, but not significantly. And we can certainly have Director Goodrum follow up if you want more specific information about the backlog.
Yes, if you would, please. And also, what's the average length of time to receive a permit? Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to apologize. I didn't brief my my department well enough, so I will say what they were supposed to say, and vitamin D. So when you're going through the permitting numbers, I'm always concerned, you know, what we're responsible for and what we're there, what the entity is waiting on for us to do versus what we're waiting on them to do. So that's a considerable difference, and I don't know where the number is, who's responsible for what. I know a lot of permits would simply be denied if we didn't work with people and say you have to go back and redo this because this is wrong or inappropriate. And I know over the years the department's been pretty good about that. Instead of just saying no, they're saying you have to fix this or this does inappropriate. So part of that scoping, and we'll go through it in the subcommittee, it's like what are we responsible for and versus waiting for the private entity to come back and fill in the numbers. Thank you.
Through the chair, this is Mark Wigan, Deputy Commissioner of DNR. My portfolio is oil and gas and Division Geologic, Geophysical, and Trust Land Office. And there is a permitting section in the oil and gas area. We're working very hard every day to tell people, the clients, the industry, to come in. If there are any problems, come in, talk to us. We give them names. We give them numbers. We'll help them as much as possible. So we're very cognizant of the fact that some people might not understand all the pathways to get the correct permits they need in the oil and gas or in the land arenas. We'll talk about it. We can surely talk about it in subcommittee.
Thank you. Thank you. And Representative Pruitt, and our fees.
Yeah, thank you. Just two questions on other funds or one is the geological center, because of the legislation a couple of years ago. How have we seen that shift in terms of the amount of money that's shifted from UGF to industry partners participating in some capacity? How have we seen that change? And you can give me an estimated percentage-wise. The other is you had highlighted the parks and outdoor recreation, that there is some additional changes that potentially be coming. If you have an idea of what direction you're going with those changes, just real briefly on those, and how that will shift, again, the percentage that it comes from fees of their budget, that is, I know that at least over the last 3 or 4 years, it went from, you know, 30% funded by fees to a much higher amount. What's your expectation once this has taken place of the percentage that will have come from fees?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, the GMC, the Geological Material Center, I believe the division has $329,000 in program receipt authority in FY18, and that's going to go up to $529,000 with this fund source change in 19. The seismic data revenue, we hope, will fill much of that bucket, and I think Deputy Commissioner Mark Wigan can speak to that a little bit more than I can.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Mark Wigan, Deputy Commissioner. We have approximately relative seismic fees. We've issued a total of 8 data sets, and we have many more in the docket that will be coming out that were shot between the 2006 and 2016 timeframe. We have 12 more sets that will be coming out in calendar year 2019 or 18 by the end of this year. So we anticipate quite a bit of fee accumulation or receipts through the seismic program. We're very excited about it.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going to page 10 to the Division of Forestry, when I look at your different categories here, where is where are the state foresters located in this, and has there been a reduction overall in state forester position, And has that had an impact on having perhaps lesser availability of timber for companies to develop the timber resources?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, I believe we have Director Chris Mesh online who may be able to best answer that question. Chris?
Yes, this is Chris Mesh, Director of the Division of Forestry. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we have positions scattered throughout the state in our area offices. For example, in Southeast Alaska, there's foresters in Ketchikan, Juneau, and Haines. But to answer your question, we took about a 35% reduction in funding and staff in the forest management side of the division. Southeast Alaska was hit particularly hard, but we have half the staff in Southeast that we had since FY16. And our program has definitely been slowed by the lack of capacity. However, we are still doing our best to meet the needs of the industry.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Pruitt, did you want to? Representative Ortiz, did you have a quick follow-up?
Quick follow-up. Can you tell me what the in the same category, what the Tongass Challenge Cost Share Agreement and Good Neighbor Authority program is about?
Yes, through the chair, Representative. Those are two federal programs where we are assisting the U.S. Forest Service with management activities on the Tongass National Forest, so on federal lands. The inventory program is helping to look at young growth and accurately inventorying the type of timber they have on the forest to then do timber sale projects with. And we are doing a lot of work with them under Good Neighbor Authority to do that. We sold our first large sale this year on federal land, and the state did all the work. We are reimbursed for all those costs, and we actually hired back some of our laid-off foresters to help with that work.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Very quick. It's, we're running over here.
Where was that timber sale? Where did that take place? Can you tell me that?
Yes, I was on Kosciuszko Island, just north of Prince of Wales, Hecata Island and then Kosciuszko. Generated about 2.6 million in sales, about 30 million feet of timber. So a very important sale for the industry for this coming year.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Pruitt.
It was the second question, if you guys wouldn't mind answering, being able to answer that.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I believe we have Ethan Tyler, the Director of Division of Parks, online, and I believe the question was, information about the change in fund sources to GGF coming up and what percentage change we're looking at?
Yeah, about what the kind of how the shift will take place in terms of the total percentage coming from fees and kind of, if you can, speak to just what you expect that the fee changes are. Are those more of commercial? Are those going to be or for private individuals? Just, you don't have to go into detail, just kind of an idea.
For the record, Ethan Tyler, Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation Director, Representative Pruitt through the chair. we're looking at a number of different ways, that we're hoping to increase revenues coming into the state park system. Currently, our revenues cover about 51% of our operational costs. Our goal is to get that up to around 60%. We're looking at doing that through a number of different ways. We're looking at putting some pricing consistency throughout our public use cabin system, increased usage in the parks through promotion, special use permit fees, and and increasing some of the areas where we're able to charge fees as well.
Hey, thank you very much, and thank you for the presentation. Look forward to the details in the subcommittees. And our next meeting is Wednesday, January 31st at 1:30 p.m. We will have presentations by the Department of Fish and Game, Commerce, Community, Economic Development, and Law. So, seeing no further questions, we'll gavel out at 352.
I am in